From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. This week, festivals that celebrate our humanity, a photographer at the peak of his career, and a composer at the beginning of his work. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call...
What'll we do?
All of this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, a film composer who has a national reputation, though he's still in his teens. But right now, though, power. Power play, power failure, power to the people. You couldn't listen to this program without power. It's a ubiquitous fact of our lives, and this year's Spirit and Place Festival aims to explore power in all its permutations. Pam Blevins-Hinkle is the Spirit and Place Festival's longtime director, and she's a powerful spokesperson for the initiative.
Spirit and Place, remind me how the theme is decided each year.
We spend a lot of time thinking about the themes, and we try to develop them 3 years ahead of time. It's a very organic process. It's probably the number one question we get is, how do you pick those themes?
Yeah.
And we actually have like a 10-point rubric where we're thinking about how relevant it is, what's going on in the community, what are the opportunities to build partnerships, what are all the different dynamics? How open is it to all the arts and religion and humanities institutions in town? And will people be interested in it? And then we talk about that with our steering committee, which is our advisory board.
Yeah, I was going to ask who the we in the sentence is. Yeah, staff and
the steering committee. There's a lot of questions to explore around power. Who holds it? How it's held? And how our culture and our communities are shaped by that.
And it has the additional beauty of its dual meanings, not just power as in personal power, political power, but also literal power from a generator, from electricity, from water, from whatever.
And certainly.
And I see that that's reflected in some of the sessions, some of the events. Remind me how those institutions from those three different parts of community life propose their sessions and how they're chosen.
Sure. So each year we put this theme out to the community, and then we invite cultural institutions, humanities, and faith-based, and not just those three, also educational and social service, and really anyone in the community who wants to express that theme through a program to apply. It's usually in early April that happens. And then we have a community selection committee, a very diverse group of people, about 12 or so, who review all those applications against a very specific criteria that we have. We're looking for events that are collaborative. We're looking for events that have the arts, humanities, and religion at the center in some way. We love it when they have lots of those things. Mm-hmm. We're looking for things that are interdisciplinary. We're looking for programs that are experiential and provide us lots of different ways into learning about the theme, and then the committee chooses them, and organizations are notified generally at the end of May or early June.
And you have 37 events this year. They're all free.
Yes, they are.
And that hasn't always been the case. That has been an evolution for the festival, I think.
It's because it's a community curated festival, we don't often know exactly how many will be free. I think that, though, it's safe to say that each year no less than 75% of the events are free to the public. That's actually a really high value for Spirit and Place, that these things are accessible to our community.
Yeah. We couldn't possibly do justice to three dozen events, but I want you to start at the end. Let's talk about the public conversation first.
Sure. So the public conversation has been an anchor, a signature event for Spirit in Place since the very beginning in 1996. And this year we're going to experiment with the public conversation a little bit. It will still, as it has always in the past, center around the arts and humanities and religion, and we'll focus on conversation. What's going to be different this year is that we're going to use the arts, humanities, and religion in a more experiential way and a performative way to look at issues around race specifically, and there's going to be an opportunity. So we'll have actors, we'll have music, and we'll have a historian and a poet, and they will interact with one another. And then there will be opportunities for the audience to actually have some conversation this year, too. So actually, you know, and I've been with Spirit in Place now 12 years, and almost every year somebody says, well, you call it a public conversation, but I don't actually get to talk any. So this year we're gonna deliver on that request that we've had actually for some time. So there will be moments where the audience is in dialogue with one another, too. So I think it'll have the historian James Madison, Mr. History for Indiana.
Yeah, very colorful speaker as well.
Very fabulous man. And the poet Aba Gunde will be here sharing as well, and she is really fantastic. And so I think that those who come faithfully every year to the public conversation, we do have groupies, isn't it great? they will be very delighted with what happens. And then I think people who haven't tried the public conversation and who are new to it will also find a lot of value in it. So we're really excited to shift this into a new space this year with the public conversation.
I know all of the events are your favorite, but tell me a couple that really intrigue you, that just jump out and you're like, oh, I'm thrilled to work at a place that is allowing this particular thing to happen.
Yeah, I it's so much fun every year to get to pick the ones. I wish I could go to all 37. I can't. It's very disappointing. I think two that I'm really looking forward to this year. One is actually nominated for one of our awards. We give an award of awesomeness each year. Mm-hmm. So one that's nominated this year is called the Almighty Pollock Paint Launch Affair. This brings science, technology, engineering, and art and math all together. So folks are going to get to go down to Garfield Park and have the opportunity to create large paintings using paint-soaked pom-poms hurled from trebuchets, catapults, and slingshots.
Does that sound therapeutic or what?
Oh, my gosh. That sounds like so much fun. It'll be, I think, a great family event, too, which we're always excited about that. I have to confess, I tend to lean toward the crazy, silly, fun ones as my favorite as opposed to the more deep and intellectual ones. I'm not sure what that says about me, but
well,
I love that.
I do remember a period where your social media profile picture was you with a colander on your head that I think was taken at once.
That's completely true. So maybe there's a clue. There is another one that's similar. It's just so fascinating. It's called Pressing Matters, Man versus Machine. And these are going to be huge, really large woodcuts that are going to be inked and pressed by a 2-ton steamroller. And then folks will get to make their own small relief prints as well. So I got to see that,
Yeah.
So one of the fun things about the festival is that, these kinds of programs aren't happening anywhere else and at any time of year. So they're really a unique opportunity.
What do you want somebody who's come to one or another session, what do you want people to do after whether they tiptoe into the Spirit in Place Festival or spend the entire festival soaking up everything? What do you want people to do or be or think differently?
I want people to have a different appreciation for the community they live in. I want them to have seen something, some capacity about their city or some capacity about their neighbors that they didn't see before. So whether that's a crazy arts event and they think, wow, this city has some wonderfully creative, unusual things, or it's a deeper intellectual event, or it's a program about climate change, then I'd want them to come away with a sense of their own agency in that issue and how they can take action, either locally or across the country or across the world, is to really see their own, to see the place they live, this place we call home, in a different way, and to see themselves in that place in a new way.
Pam Blevensinkel is a key part of the power grid behind the Spirit in Place Festival. The theme this year is power, and you can check out how power works at dozens of events throughout the city from November 3rd through the 12th.
The Spirit in Place crew would like you to RSVP if you plan to attend the newly interactive public conversation on November 12th, and you can do that and plan the rest of your activities at spiritandplace.org. That's spiritandplace.org. Since 1997, the Eitelsjorg Museum has held its biennial Contemporary Art Fellowship program to celebrate and reward the best Native American and Western artists at work today. Now the museum has organized Native Art Now, a traveling exhibition of some of the best of the artworks of the past 25 years. Native Art Now also features a TV documentary created by our sister station WFYI-TV, plus a two-day convening of leading Native artists, scholars, curators, and other leaders in the field. I invited Eitelsjorg Assistant Curator of Native American Art, Doreen Redcloud, to tell me about this new initiative. You've been at the Eitelsjorg not quite a year, and this project's been kind of your baby since you got here.
Yes.
So you probably knew about the Contemporary Art Fellowships from having been in the field, but mm-hmm. when you got to Indianapolis and started working on this project, what was your perception of that program?
My perception was that it's much larger and more important than I thought it was. I had heard about it before, being an artist, not of the caliber artist that is usually selected for a fellow. But I think I first heard about the fellowship when I was at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And my first thought was, I wish more museums were doing this for contemporary Native artists. And as time has gone on and I've become more involved with the project, helping Jennifer Complo McNutt, our curator of contemporary art, this is just going to be a major historic important moment in the field of contemporary Native art.
And I like the scope of Native Art Now because it incorporates some of the finest of the finest works that the museum has acquired over the history of the fellowship. But it also has some what sound like pretty substantial elements for artists, for museum professionals, a TV documentary, the two-day convening of artists. What kind of attendance are you expecting from that convening? Do you have any sense yet?
I believe that we're expecting anywhere from 100 to 200 people, consisting of presidents of museums, curators from different museums and institutions, pretty much anyone who's involved in the field of contemporary Native art. And there are a total of 50 fellows. Five have passed on. And we believe we're going to get about 30 to 35 fellows to attend.
Whoa, that's going to be a power session.
I can't wait to meet
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely, yeah. So what, I'm not going to ask you what your favorite pieces are out of these 39 works, but what are some of the pieces that you feel maybe best represent some of the themes that are going on in contemporary Native art?
Well, the first person that comes to mind is Jean Quick to see Smith and her piece with the paper dolls. She had done these, and they look like
paper dolls, kind of like Barbie doll sized. Or
yes, she named some of them like Ken, and now I can't think of his last name,
a
Native American name. But there are themes about smallpox and themes about which relates to diseases that were spread to Native Americans upon contact, stereotypes. Well, Jean herself has been a spokesperson for Native artists since the 1980s, and her piece comes to mind first because I've been a longtime admirer of hers, and she's a very strong woman, not afraid to speak her mind and tell the art world, hey, we're artists first and foremost, we deserve the credit and attention and recognition that any other contemporary artist deserve. There's so many wonderful artists in this exhibit. Truman Lowe, Merrill McMaster, Wendy Redstar, Joe Fetterson, Rick Bartow. It's hard to really choose any more pieces because I could probably talk about each and every one of them. They're all so important. Talking about issues on identity and sovereignty and just doing art for the sake of doing art.
Doreen Redcloud is Assistant Curator of Native American Art for the Idlejord Museum. She's been working with the museum's longtime curator of contemporary art, Jennifer Complo McNutt, on Native Art Now. It opens to the public on Sunday, November 12th, and you can learn lots more about this new traveling exhibition and its associated TV special and gathering of professionals at idlejorg.org, EITELJORG.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Just around the corner, a new photography exhibit by Indie's own Bill Foley. But first, every week, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger takes a culinary journey with a local professional. Here's this week's conversation.
We're talking today with Patrick Nice about the upcoming Emerging Indiana Food Brands Forum. Patrick, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me in.
Well, so the Emerging Indiana Food Brands Forum will be held November 6th at Purdue. Tell us just a little bit about the forum and, you know, what it is and what its goals are.
So it has has three different main components. There's workshop classes in the morning, both in Purdue Food Sciences and in marketing. And then the afternoon is what I kind of think is the centerpiece of it, is a food buyers panel. And then the afternoon, there's a table set up for tasting so the buyers can walk around and taste. It truly is for the food entrepreneur. So food buyers from retail is what this is about. Their job is to get the right products on the shelf. And generally, when you talk to a food entrepreneur who's not that far down the path, maybe just above a farmer's market or have some of their product on some shelves around town of just, you know, neighborhood or independent grocery stores, they don't necessarily think about the fact that their first customer they have to sell to is the gatekeeper of the retail. So that's the food buyer. They decide what goes on the shelf. No matter how much you know about that end consumer that may want your product, you have to get that prepared and sold right into the retail environment, to the gatekeeper first.
So why is something like this important right now for our local food entrepreneurs? You know, we hear a lot about our food scene kind of exploding here in Indianapolis and in central Indiana. Is right now a key time for some of our local entrepreneurs?
That's a really good question, and it truly is the right time. All across the board, across the nation, but in Indiana is a good example. Locally sourced food is becoming one of the biggest trends for consumers. What that really means is that they do like to go to the farmer's market, but they also want to go to their regular retail environments and buy locally sourced food. There's a lot of factors across the board of why this is going on, but some of them are that I hate to say it, but it's kind of a distrust of big food, and that's kind of millennials driving that. There's some trends and some great reports out there that they want to know what's in their food more. There's almost an instinctual drive to say that if you know where the company is and they're close to us, that there's a way of accountability and trust that kind of gets attached to that, which is kind of a neat way to look at it. But what really does is it opens up the markets. So you have the Kroger or a Martin Supermarkets or Fresh Time come into the market, and they're literally sourcing local food to kind of be on the same shelf as a national brand sometimes, but to be able to to be available for the trends.
So major retailers are looking for local?
That's exactly what's happening. So they are, and that's really what the conference is all about, is these food entrepreneurs are probably not far down the path at all. So if you think about what the food buyers are doing at that panel, here's a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of the people who registered got to pose two questions that they would want to ask a retailer.
Okay, that's great.
So in the centerpiece, that buyer's roundtable, where I have six buyers from different retail environments, distributors, Martin Supermarkets, Fresh Time, all sitting at a panel, we're going to compose those questions, and that's going to drive the whole lunch panel, is answering the questions that are posed by the audience on how to get their food on the shelf, the questions are fantastic.
What are some of the things that they're concerned about?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like, how much growth do you plan to see or do you forecast to see in the local and organic food sector? Is it going to keep rising is what they're asking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are two things you look for in a food vendor? You know, what are the first steps to getting a meeting with a buyer like you? So there are all these questions that are really capturing, and it makes me really I can't tell you how excited I am, because it makes me happy that we're touching a nerve that is really looking, being, you know, sought after. And it goes back to the core of saying we don't, we have aspirations to grow our companies. Mm-hmm. We need to know the steps.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Hindi Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, what you need to understand to write film scores. But right now, the latest exhibit at Marion University Visual Arts Gallery features portraits of women who've happily spent most of their life out of the public eye. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here with more on Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Bill Foley's new show titled The Twilight of Oldenburg. I'm intrigued.
It's a beautiful show, and these are beautiful women. They're nuns. They're sisters. And Bill also teaches photography at Marion. And even though he has shot award-winning and newsworthy photographs of some of the most famous and influential people around the world, he says that these very simple yet elegant portraits of the members of the Sisters of St. Francis may be his best yet. The Order of Nuns actually started Marion University. It was still Marion College back in 1937. Bill started teaching there about 10 years ago, and he struck up friendships with a number of the sisters who were still actually working and teaching on campus at the time. But over the years, many of them have retired, so that means that Bill goes and travels down to southern Indiana, where he visits the sisters at the Oldenburg Convent.
And I would take Sister Janice to lunch, and I'd hang out with Sister Stella, and I'd bring them chocolate and cookies and all that stuff. And then I just decided, well, maybe this could be a project. So working with the activities director at Moldenberg, Mary Ellen Ricklin, I started to, you know, sign up for, you know, we'd have a sign-up sheet for the portrait. And I would go to Moldenberg, and I'd set up a black seamless, one light, and a bounce guard. This little studio I would make, it's in the hearth room, and the sisters would come in, and I'd say, "Sister, how are you?" And they'd tell me what they'd been doing before, and they'd been in Papua New Guinea, or they'd been in Dayton, Ohio, and they'd been principals, and they'd been school teachers, and CEOs, and CFOs, and all these amazing careers. And I discovered many of them have doctorates. And, you know, you were talking about a really amazing group of women.
Tell me what that process is like. What when you approach one of the nuns, what goes in? What's a photo shoot with a nun like?
Yeah, you know, it's wonderful. You know, it's funny. I was telling somebody the other day that whenever I get to go to Oldenburg, the minute I see the Oldenburg sign, I get calmer. I just start to relax. The sisters would come into my little studio, and they'd say, "Oh, hi, sister. How are you?" And they say, "Oh, I'm great." And they'd sit in the chair, and we'd chat. So I'd say, "Sister, how old are you?" And they'd say, "Oh, 88, or they'd say, 91. And I'd say, "You've got to be kidding me, because nobody looks their age. They all look much younger. And they've all got this great this sensibility and this wonderful sense about, you know, who they are."
Were they shy about being photographed?
Actually, some of them were reluctant. But the minute they would see the picture, they'd go, "Oh, yes, let's do this."
Did you get out of it what you had expected you were going to get when you went into it, or did it somehow change during the course of the project?
You know, it really, what happened was, it actually worked out better than I expected. Because I had no idea what I was going to get. I had no idea going into this. I mean, Sister Janice, I really knew very well. I mean, Sister Stella... But I became, you know, really friends with a lot of these sisters that I didn't really know, the headmen on campus. And, you know, as it turned out, it worked out for them and for me, I think, because I think we got some great pictures out of it. We got some great little stories out of it. And I think at the end of the day, it's a pretty good piece of work. But I think, you know, the other thing, I credit the sisters, not myself. Because they were so good about, you know, just, you know, being in the moment and saying, "Great, let's do this." And, you know, nobody, when they got in front of the camera, clammed up, nobody froze up, nobody, you know, said, "Oh, I don't want to do this."
The show is up from October the 18th through November the 10th. They'll be having a reception on November the 9th from 4 to 6 p.m. Bill says many of the nuns are going to attend that reception. He took photographs of over 50 of the nuns down there, and he says they're going to try to get as many of them on a bus as they can to get up to see the show, although, because they're humble, many of them want to come before the reception so they can just see the show and not be the subject of the reception. They want the pictures to be the subject of it. But it's a truly spectacular show that was born out of the right thing, friendship and respect.
Fantastic. I can't wait to see it. Well, we have lots of other things that you can see and do on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
Well, if you like films, you might not even be near the radio. You might be out working on your schedule for the Heartland Film Festival, which is up through the 22nd of October. And some of the most amazing films that in many cases are not in the mainstream. You can find out lots more at Heartland website. So go there and plot your attack.
And up now at the Bona Thompson Memorial Center is The Devil in the Circle City, The Mystery Unravels. It's artifacts relating to H.H. Holmes, offering a 19th century fascination with some murders and some really interesting people from that area, including the American Ripper story. So it's on display in that memorial center there. The hours are kind of unusual. They're Wednesdays one and Saturday and Sunday 1 to 3. But I think if you go to their website, they might let you have your own little special tour, because it's a pretty interesting exhibit. And, of course, just in time for Halloween.
Love it. H.H. Holmes, if you're thinking, wow, that's a familiar name. He was the guy in The Devil in the White City.
Yes, that's right.
Speaking of creepy things, film historian Eric Grayson will screen the classic 1939 film Son of Frankenstein this very evening at the Garfield Park Art Center at 8 o'clock. There's popcorn and other refreshments, and Son of Frankenstein stars Boris Karloff, Basil Rathbone, and Bela Lugosi. Perfect film to get you in the mood for Halloween. You can find out more at drfilm.net, which is Eric Grayson's blog.
The 2017 Quilt Show by the Quilters Guild of Indianapolis takes place October 20th and 21st from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Westfield Middle School up in Westfield. Over 400 quilts to see. I saw their show that they did in Broad Ripple Park this summer, and it's fascinating. There are women and a few men of all ages, and some of them sew the quilts by hand. Others use machines, and they all have powerful messages. It's just a fun thing for the whole family, and the exhibit is free on October 20th and 21st.
If I say Colonel Mustard in the library with a candlestick and you're like, oh my gosh, I know what that is, listen up, because for one night only, the Indiana Historical Society is inviting guests to take part in a whodunit, a life-size clue-inspired murder mystery experience that's coming up this Friday, October 20th. You will roam the halls of the History Center to find clues, and you can find out so much more at indianahistory.org about that.
And New York writer Ariana Rhines is going to be at the Tube Factory on October 21st from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. Remember, she worked with local artist Larissa Hammond on Larissa's exhibit that we previewed and told you about here on Art of the Matter, that is up at the Tube Factory as well. That exhibit will end on the 21st. She and Larissa had a lot of conversations, and those conversations are explored in Larissa's work and also an audio exhibit that's part of that exhibit. Get to meet and talk with Ariana on the 21st from 1 to 3 at the Tube Factory down there in Garfield Park.
Well, don't forget you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or tune in next week for our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Coming up, a three-week festival for lovers of books and the arts. But now to a composer who is not yet old enough to vote or drink. Ashton Gleckman is a 17-year-old musical prodigy who founded the band Rising Gravity Experience when he was just 10. A few years after that, Ashton got interested in film music. He studied and worked in New York City and Los Angeles, and his L.A. experience included an internship for Remote Control Productions, run by the world-renowned composer Hans Zimmer. Ashton's newest project was scoring the music for the film Hidden, which tells the story of children hidden during the Holocaust. Hidden will premiere in Indianapolis on November 2nd, and contributor Shannon Forsell reached Ashton in L.A. to find out what it's like working in an intense field at such a young age.
So, Ashton, this is amazing to me. You're a 17-year-old musical prodigy. You founded a band called Rising Gravity at 10 years old. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was called Rising Gravity Experience. I formed that at 10 years old. We recorded our first CD in Nashville in 2013. We had a big CD release party in Indianapolis in 2014. And then it was in November of 2014 when I entered this world of film music and all that type of stuff.
So now you're in film music, and I'm interviewing you while you're in California working on a film.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. That's an ambitious and awesome thing. And so you're working on a film called Hidden. And you're working on the music for that film, which is a story about the children hidden during the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Tell me about the process of how this happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So Guy Orman has been a really good friend of mine for a couple of years. I saw this guy post on this one forum, this video of footage that he shot at Auschwitz, the concentration camp. And it was this big, long, beautiful, beautiful video with awesome aerial footage. And it was really impactful. And I asked him, like, what is this for? Is the project that this is for, does it need any music or something? And he was like, yeah, sure. And he gave me the video, and I wrote 2 minutes of music for it. And he sent that to the director. And the director at the time, who is Guy Orman, he was working on a film called Once Upon a Family, which was the story of the Polish Jews during, before and after the Holocaust. And he hired this guy to take aerial footage of Auschwitz to include in the film. So when he sent Dee this 2-minute video with my music on it, at first he wasn't going to have original music. He was just going to use music off of some type of production music service online or something. But then he finally was like, oh, this might actually be a good idea to include an original score. It might add something interesting to the film. So I worked on that film with him, and then come 2 years later, he contacted me about this project he's working on called Hidden, and it's this extraordinary documentary film about children during the Holocaust. It includes some unbelievable interviews from people who were there, people who helped save these people's lives. It includes beautiful historical reenactments that were actually shot in Poland on location at these places where it actually happened. So that's a really, really cool thing. And when it comes to composing the music for any film, what it's really about is sitting there, having a conversation with the director, understanding the director's vision for the project, what he wants to tell, the story he wants to tell, sitting through the film, deciding where the music's going to go and what the music's role should be. And very, very early on Hidden, we really decided that we wanted the music to be a direct sort of translation of the emotion of the film. So the music has some sadness, but some hopeful qualities. It has some darkness at some points. But, the film as a whole is really about hope and about bravery and about coming out of the darkness on the other side and becoming stronger through that whole ordeal.
Wow. And this film is actually going national, and you're going to be coming back home, so to speak, to Indianapolis at the Keystone Landmark Theater, and that's going to be shown on November 2nd at 6:30, and there's going to be a Q&A session with you after, correct?
Yeah, so it's going to be me and Guy. It's going to be at the Landmark Keystone Art Cinema And it's going to, I believe it's November 2nd at 7 o'clock in the evening. So after the movie, we're going to pretty much answer any questions people have regarding the process of composing the music, regarding the process of him creating the film as a whole. And so it'll just be a time, if anyone has any questions from, you know, because it'll, of course, be directly after they watch the movie. So hopefully they'll have some questions about the process that it took to create it. But yeah, that'll be great.
Wow. And it looks like all ticket sales are going to go to the Holocaust Education at Witness, yeah. Project Witness.
Yeah. So all the ticket sales are going to, yeah, Project Witness. And Project Witness is an extraordinary company who is really the people that are responsible for commissioning projects like Hidden and projects like Once Upon a Family. They're the people that commission these projects, and then these companies, Big Productions, is in charge of creating the documentaries from the ground up.
Wow. Well, this is so exciting. There's a lot more to ask you, but folks are going to have to ask you at your question and answer session on November 2nd. But best of luck to you. This is so amazing, and we'll all look forward to seeing you on November 2nd.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Contributor Shannon Forsell with teen film composer Ashton Gleckman. You can hear his work when the film Hidden is screened on November 2nd at 6:30 at Landmark Keystone Art Theater. And following the film, there'll be a Q&A session with Ashton and director G. Orman. Find out more at landmarktheaters.com. And if you're intrigued by Ashton, you can listen to music, watch videos, and more at ashtongleckman.com. The JCC's 19th annual Anne Katz Festival of Books and Arts brings our community 3 weeks packed full of intellectually stimulating, fun, and even delicious offerings. I invited the JCC's Director of Arts and Education, Lev Rothenberg, to share some highlights.
Tradition, I'm going to ask you to remind us who Anne Katz was and why we have a festival in her honor and memory.
Yes, Anne Katz was a lovely lady who believed so strongly in the arts and in literature. She was the wife of Irv Katz from Katz, Zapper & Miller. And in fact, I'm so glad to say this, just recently the Katz family created an endowment fund that has helped us support the festival in perpetuity and also support arts and education.
That's fabulous. What a loving thing to do.
Oh, yeah. It was their son and daughter that decided to do that.
Yeah. It's a way to live in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy, no pressure or anything, but you're in your 19th year tomorrow. You're going to have to really, next year, you're going to have to really pull out all the stops for the 20th. But I think you've kind of done that on the 19th. You have a really stellar lineup.
I think this year is our most diverse, entertaining and impressive lineup. I'm thrilled to go to the programs.
Now that must be a litmus test if you have to be a part of the blood, sweat, and tears of planning something and you're still excited about going to it.
I think that's true. Yeah.
7 authors, 3 evenings of film screenings, 5 events, 2 family-friendly and free, 3 performing arts events. Where do you want to start? Knowing that we can't do justice all of those, but
well, I want to mention Stephen Tobolowsky. He kicks it off on October 23rd. He's a man whose name you might not know. Everybody knows his face because he's a character actor everywhere. I know him best from Groundhog Day, Ned Ryerson. And he has written a book, and as I told him, a lot of famous people write books because, like, I'm a famous person, and they don't have much to say.
Right.
Stephen Tobolowsky has written a book that is incredibly humorous and at the same time incredibly wise.
I love the name of it.
Yeah, yeah. My Adventures with God. And it explains it. And it's a fun book. It's probably one of my very favorite books of the year. And then we have Jonathan Eig coming November 1st. We found out about him through a friend. He's written a book called Ali, A Life, which I recently finished. Just amazing, so well researched, and has since been on numerous can't-miss lists as far as reads for fall. Entertainment Weekly, People Magazine. So that's going to be really exciting.
And it's billed as the definitive biography of the late, great Muhammad Ali.
And I could see where it would be. I'm not a Muhammad Ali expert, except that I've read the definitive biography.
Yeah.
And he spent years researching this. He's a great writer also.
Fantastic. For people who like to cook, I love the JCC. You always you hit my weak spot. You always do things about food. And you're having a cooking demonstration, tasting, but here's something that doesn't flow naturally, and comedy event? Explain.
Absolutely. We're bringing in a team, a comedian, Joel Chasnoff, and a very well-known chef and New York City restaurant owner, a winner of the TV show Chopped 3 times. Mm. And they work together. So it will be both fun, comedy, humorous, and cooking, and of course, tasting.
So if you think there's nothing funny about, say, parsley, you should come and find out what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. I have been reading about it, and I admit I haven't gotten a copy yet, of Leaving Lucy Pear. Tell us about this novel.
Yeah, this is a novel by a wonderful woman who lives in the Chicago area. It's our book club choice, so we're inviting book clubs from all over the city to read the book, talk about it, and then come meet with the author. And it's a story that takes place, if I recall, around the turn of the century, about a person who, a woman who actually gets left underneath a pear tree in hopes that somebody will come and
as
take
an infant,
her.
Yeah.
And then it's very intriguing the way she grows up and the way everything comes together.
Most of these events we're talking about have the opportunity for Q&A or some sort of audience participation, right?
Yes. Basically, all of the authors are happy to do Q&A. And, in fact, our films, one of the films that we're bringing in, they played for their lives, which is really about the power of music that got children through the Holocaust. And now they're adults. They're, you know, in their 80s. And we're bringing in the filmmaker. And we are also bringing in one of the subjects of the film, who's in his 80s, happens to live in the Indianapolis area.
Wow.
And still plays accordion. So there will be discussion, question and answer, and there will be music. It's about as uplifting a movie as a Holocaust movie can be, because it talks about yeah. the power, the inner power of music to get you through literally anything.
Speaking of which, the author of Why, Explaining the Holocaust,
yes.
is part of your celebration.
Absolutely. We reached out to Peter Hayes, who has won numerous awards as the favorite professor at Northwestern University. He is also a world-renowned authority on the Holocaust. And he's written a book that really, it's scholarly but very, very interesting, that asks some very key questions and breaks some myths, like why the Jews? Why Germany? Why didn't they fight back? Why didn't the world do anything?
Hmm.
And it's brilliantly written, and it's important, and there are also lessons for the world that we live in today.
Mm-hmm. Timely, no matter what the
Very
time frame
much,
is.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to mention one of your events that, and forgive me, dear listeners, if this is sold out by the time you hear this, but way to go, you scored Chuck Todd as a guest.
We are just thrilled. We are so excited. And yes, we are close to sold out. So when this is aired, by all means, check with the
right.
JCC. But it's going to be wonderful. And we're going to have him talking with a local news person here. We'll be in conversation.
And if you're
him.
Like, that name's kind of familiar, but I can't place him. He's managing editor of Meet the Press. He was chief White House correspondent for NBC, named the most powerful journalist in Washington a few years ago.
Yeah.
So a guy
yeah.
in the know.
Yeah, just brilliant.
Speaking of politics, your Mickey's Corner should be fascinating this year.
Yeah. We, Mickey's Corner has developed quite a following. Our last one was indeed last year during the festival. And this year, we're bringing Mayor Hogsett. So it's going to be an interesting time. I've had the opportunity to see Mayor Hogsett. And for a politician, he's incredibly entertaining, fun, but at the same time, that doesn't imply that there's no ballast there.
Sure.
So Mickey's Corner, if it's like other Mickey's Corners, it will go all the way back to his childhood. It will talk about how did you become who you are. It will delve into who you are. And once again, there will be the opportunity for questions and answers. Mickey Maurer does a phenomenal job on this.
Lev, I'm so sorry. We're going to have to send people to your website to learn about family-friendly events, more about films and about visual art. You've got pretty much something for everybody during this festival.
We absolutely do. We're very proud of this. Our 19th Ann Katz Festival of Books and Arts, presented by the Herbert Simon Family Foundation.
Break a leg.
Thanks.
Lev Rothenberg is JCC Indy's Director of Arts and Education. The 19th Annual Ann Katz Festival of Books and Arts is a three-week feast from October 23rd through November 13th. More than 5,000 people will attend, but there's room for you, too. Learn about the talks, films, cooking demonstrations, and much more at jccindy.org. Oh, and by the way, that Chuck Todd event is sold out already. So sorry. But go to jccindy.org for all of the other events. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. The Jazz Kitchen will host an extraordinary concert this Sunday, October 15th, when a pair of virtuoso pianists join forces for a celebration of contemporary Argentine tango music. The program is part of the American Pianist Association's Grand Encounters series, and it features American pianist Christopher O'Reilly partnering with the Buenos Aires tango maestro Pablo Ziegler. And I have five songs for you now featuring Pablo Ziegler on piano. Pablo grew up studying classical piano in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and later developed a serious passion for jazz. But Pablo also had strong feelings for the national music of his homeland. I recently spoke with Pablo via phone, and he told me early on in life, he hated tango music.
Really, at that time when you started to play jazz, being a teenager, we hate tango. We consider tango like a cheap music, yeah?
But it was an encounter with tango composer Astor Piazzolla that changed Pablo's mind about the music.
I heard in the radio for the first time Piazzolla's music. And I said, oh my God, this guy is incredible.
Pablo eventually joined Piazzolla's group and was the featured pianist in Piazzolla's ensemble from 1978 until Piazzolla's death in 1992. Let's play a composition now from the first record Pablo made with Astor Piazzolla. This is from the 1986 album, Tango Zero Hour. Play one more track from Pablo's time with tango icon Astor Piazzolla. This is from a collaboration Piazzolla's group recorded with the Indiana jazz legend Gary Burton. We're going to hear Operation Tango from a 1988 disc called The New Tango. I want to switch things up with something different. In 1999, Pablo recorded a collaboration with the Argentine rock band Los Fabulosos Cadillacs, one of the most important rock bands in Latin America. From their 1999 collaboration, this is 57 Almas.
next, let's listen to a track from one of Pablo's solo recordings. From his 1998 album Street Tango, this is Asfalto. Play a track from Pablo's most recent recording, Tango Nuevo, with Christopher O'Reilly. The album features duet performances with O'Reilly and Ziegler. And if you like what you hear, you can catch Christopher O'Reilly and Pablo Ziegler live at the Jazz Kitchen this Sunday, October 15th. Advance tickets are available at AmericanPianists.org. And take note, this is an early show. Doors open at 2:30 p.m. and the music starts at 4.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Jill Dittmeyer and Shannon Forsell. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, a photography exhibit that celebrates the special power of tattoos in the lives of veterans, bringing back the spirit of burlesque and vaudeville, and Where Would You Like to Wake Up Tomorrow? And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.